This is Richard Roth with The Passage, a monthly show on WGXC devoted to the creative life. My guest this month is David Eustace, a Canadian artist who has spent quite a little time in the area, also has lived in Brooklyn. We'll be back for a residency at the McDerris Gallery on Warren Street later this year. After the interview, Bob Amal and Taj Mahal with Trouble Sleep Yanga Wakeam.
This is Richard Roth, and I am here with David Eustace, an artist from Canada who's spent some time in Hudson and hopes to spend some time in the future. David, welcome.
Thanks, Richard, for having me.
Now, how did you first hear about Hudson?
I'd been working and living in Brooklyn, and as I think a lot of people here have, and found myself coming up here kind of recreationally, and then
visiting friends and whatnot.
Visiting friends, and you know, checking out the Hudson Valley. And at a certain point, I decided to leave the city and come up, and I was involved in a photography project that the Hudson Valley just seemed like the place to be.
I see.
Yeah.
And what was the photography project?
It was a time-lapse video project, and what I did was take a bunch of these time-lapse cameras. They're actually trail cameras or hunting cameras, and set them out in the woods. And at first, I was just curious about what I would capture. I think I was thinking about animals and things like this. But I soon realized that the landscape itself was the subject, and that this project that it went on for a year and a half, the landscape was the subject, and it just took time for me to sort of understand that. And
when you say time lapse, how often was it taking a picture?
It varied. You know, I at first had it every minute, and I just was getting such a phenomenal amount of footage that I cut that down to 5 minutes. Different sites, I tried different time periods. And I think on average about every 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, a picture would be taken. In the end, I have an archive of, I think it's over a million still photographs. So
wow.
They accumulate
now,
quickly.
Now, this was during daylight hours only or 24
no,
hours?
No, it was 24 hours. So these cameras are really neat. They have an infrared capacity and a sensor so that if an animal did happen to sort of traverse between the set times, it would take a photo. So 24/7 was the program for those. So
did that happen occasionally, that animals would
quite a bit actually it? You know, no surprise to the people who live here, tons of deer and I don't know, turkeys. I think the animals have to be big enough to trigger it. So
did they have any reaction? I mean, could you tell that they'd heard anything or something like that? Did they go dashing off or whatever?
That's a great question. Yeah, I have a lot of pictures of the rear ends of deers, actually, because I think that there's a subtle click. I don't hear it, but that there are quite a few pictures. There's the initial one that they trigger, and then a second one where they're kind of staring in the direction of the camera as though, you know, they're quite aware of it. So
how far from the ground is the camera?
I varied that. You know, I climbed trees because I thought, okay, this might be an interesting vantage point. I put them very low to the ground. A couple of them were buried in the winter. I mean, just the volume of snow sort of. And that actually was quite interesting because it, you know, over the course of the snowfall of the day, it just slowly kind of eclipsed the view of the landscape and then melted again. So there's a kind of there was a kind of nice rhythm to those. I'm quite fond of those ones. So
now, is everything self-contained in the camera, the battery and everything?
Yeah, everything's there. And I a couple of them I managed to attach some solar panels. I would have to go out and change the batteries. But yeah, they're these great, you know, weatherproof.
How often would the batteries have to be changed if they were, you know, the standard lithium or something?
I use rechargeables. So actually, the more I use, the more often I had to change them. But, you know, once every couple of weeks, I would go out and check the cameras, swap out the video cards, and then carry on that way.
And how many locations did you use for these cameras?
So I had a half a dozen cameras, and two of them I left at two sites for the entire duration, so for the 18 months. And then the other four I rotated anywhere from a season, so 3 months. One that was sort of my vagabond camera, I call it, just would every couple of weeks I would change the location. So I think in total it's something like 14, 15 sites. So
and they were all along the river?
No, this is up in near Austerlitz. So it's I kind of picked the deep woods, and I wanted to get some height, you know, just some elevation, landscape elevation.
On some of somebody's property.
Yeah, it was actually a private commission and part of a private commission, and the landowner said, you know, go for it. I just said, hey, can I put some cameras around? And you know, that was part of the project for them. And then of course all this footage, it just sort of demanded more attention afterwards.
Is this something you'd done before, a similar project where you used time-lapse cameras?
No, it was my first time, and actually it's interesting the way I came about it was I was sitting out, I remember really distinctly, I was sitting at a kitchen table and I was looking out a window and a bird had landed on the railing and it had a moth in its mouth, and I thought, wow, what a fantastic picture. So I put the camera, just a you know, digital camera on top of a coffee mug to steady it, and I started taking pictures and realized, hey, this is going to be really cool, this sort of time-lapse thing. And for a couple of weeks, that's what I did, is just use a regular digital camera set up on a tripod, and I would sort of hang around different parts and sort of shoot by hand, either every minute. Sometimes it would, you know, I'd spend the whole afternoon going back every 5 minutes to take a shot. And, you know, at a certain point, I thought, hey, I've got to get something to do this, you know, for me, because there's just a lot of material that I could gather that way. So
the cameras are must be fairly sturdy.
They are, as I said, they're primarily, I think, used for hunting, and they're, you know, weatherproof. They're called trail cameras. So I gather that the hunters, you know, put them in various spots to see where the feeding places are, to see if it's a good place to.
Oh, I see. So it's sort of research for where to put a blind or something like that.
Yeah. They're sort of predatory in that way. So, and I actually like that, because I did. I looked at different models, and I thought, no, this is kind of seems sort of appropriate.
Now, who makes them?
Bushnell,
which is a camera maker.
A camera maker. Yeah, and they're. I didn't get this particular kind, but you can get them in camo. I just. You know, got the standard black one, but so yeah, they're geared for more towards hunting. And
how large is the camera?
I'm going to say 4 inches tall by 3 inches wide by about 2 inches thick, four or 6 inches maybe tall.
Maybe half the size of a standard SLR then, maybe.
Yeah. You know, they're not huge. They're not tiny. You know, spy cameras.
How did you find out about them?
Oh, the internet. You know, I just a quick Google search time lapse, and they popped up, and they just, as I said, I really, for some reason, I liked this, that the fact that they, you know, they're designed for hunters, and just to sort of co-opt that, and again, this sort of predatory flavor to them, really, I don't know, somehow delighted me.
Did you encounter any hunters in your setting things up?
No, I didn't actually. That's Yeah, I think because primarily I put them on private land, and I think that that sort of obviated any chance of really coming across hunters. Although the land was next to a state park, so you know, in my wanderings, I did actually a couple times. One time, I came across a guy. I literally walked by him, and he sort of coughed, and I looked down, and he's all outfitted in his gear and whatnot. So that was a bit of a surprise, but.
So this is up on top of the hill, like around the Malay Colony, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, by Harvey Mountain, BB Hill State Park.
And then, so the primary product then was the video you would make out of these still shots?
Yeah, I did, as part of this commission, I did some large-scale drawings for the property owner. But for my part, yeah, this massive archive kind of constitutes the main product of that project.
And as far as the million images, they're all on digital storage.
They're all on a variety of hard drives, some of which have stopped working. So at some point, I'll have to, when, you know, when I get the money, I'll have to get those images extracted. But yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny. I meant to calculate sort of how many gigabytes that is. But yeah, I have a box of external drives that house these.
Are the images themselves fairly high resolution?
They're good, 8 megapixels. So they're nice, and they're color. Yeah, they're actually quite good quality. I was pleased.
So, are you planning to utilize something like this in your next project?
I am. You know, before we started, as I was saying to you, you know, I really hesitate to say what I'm going to do because, you know, as we were talking about, it invariably changes. One of the things I am excited about is to go down and work with the kids at Kite's Nest. You know, get them involved a little bit in this because I'm really curious in terms of, you know, a kid's conception of time is just so different than ours, and to sort of get them thinking along these lines and have a tool with which to sort of explore, you know, a season, a week, whatever they want to do. But I'm pretty excited because I think the results will be surprising.
How old are the kids down there?
I think the ages range from 7 to 12. I think that's a general.
Do they go to school at the public school as well?
Yes, it's an after-school program.
I see.
They come down and, I mean, it's a fantastic program. They build all sorts of things. The organization itself gets a whole variety of skills to come in and be introduced to the kids and...
And you will outfit them with cameras.
Yes, yeah. So that's kind of the destination for some of these cameras that I have. Because I'm not sure. I still have this archive, so I'm not sure I need any more footage right now to deal with myself. But the idea will be I will go down and chat with them and give them some cameras and set up some sort of program for us to work with over, you know, the next period that I'm here. So...
I imagine they could find fairly interesting subjects within a stone's throw of the basilica, right?
Yeah. You know, and as I said, you know, I'm really interested in what their interpretation of time and how they view it, and vis-a-vis using these cameras. And then, yeah, as you point out, it's an interesting landscape down there. You know, there's a lot of interesting things to look at.
When you showed these images, the ones that I saw, it was at Wendy McDerris Gallery.
Yeah.
And you had them set up in such a way that you sort of looked through a peephole in a canvas.
Yeah, and that was, you know, Wendy set it all up, and we had talked, you know, over the preceding months. We just, by email, we've been communicating. She sort of said, how do you envision these things? And the first idea was to project them onto the side of the building. You know, we thought, okay, this is going to be great, big, huge image. And it was beyond our technical expertise, frankly. So going in the other direction, yeah, the idea was, so on the 7th Street wall, there's a nice little window. It was covered in canvas, and an inch-by-inch hole was cut out. And I think we both really love the idea of a peephole. It just sort of, there was something, you know, we put it at a height so that you kind of had to crouch down and look into it. And what you saw was this changing landscape from winter to spring. And it was a kind of ode to spring. We both sort of delighted in this sort of seedy edge to the idea of a peephole. I don't know, uh-huh. Peephole on Warren Street.
Voyeuristic.
A little voyeuristic.
How did people know to look? Was there a sign or something?
There was an arrow. There was a black arrow just sort of pointing to it. And then in the front window, as you saw, there was another sort of canvas set up with a monitor kind of poking through. And those videos were the short ones that I shot with the camera. They were.
Did you leave it running all night?
All night, all day. It was up for, I think, 3 weeks and 24/7, as I seem to like. I like this sort of relentless relentless video projection or taking. So, well, I'll tell you what was interesting about some of this footage was I got some fantastic shots. And what I love about this is it was this sort of dead eye of just this mechanical, mindless camera taking pictures. And I'll tell you, if you take a million photographs, you're going to get some really good ones. I mean, they looked composed. They looked like someone had spent a lot of time thinking about them, but just blind luck. So that was sort of a side product of it, of the project, is just to sort of see, you know, odds are if you take enough pictures, you're going to get some really nice ones.
Picasso said that was the secret, make a lot. Did you print them as well? Some of them?
I did. You know, I played around with the because, you know, they're kind of stop animation time lapse. It's like a flip book, right? So I did print some up in book form to try to, get an old-fashioned flip book going.
As a flip book,
yeah. But I didn't actually, the ones that I just referred to, the kind of, classic landscape photographs, I didn't print them. And, you know, maybe I will at some point, but it's interesting because, in terms of authorship and whatnot, I really feel like I would have to put the camera's name next to it and not mine because I literally didn't take them. Yeah, so, but yeah, I certainly have a lot to choose from, so.
Were you always interested in photography?
You know, this is going to sound strange. I've never been interested in photography. This project really came out of the blue for me. You know, my main practice is, works on canvas and painter, works on canvas and paper. And this sort of photography element is relatively new. And, I think for me it's less about taking photographs and this process of, incrementally capturing time passing. The works on canvas as you've seen, a lot of them deal with this deep time, which is long, astronomical stretches of time. And the photography work kind of shrunk that world down to seasons, to a rainstorm, to really sort of like human events, I guess, things that I could understand. So it's the process interested me, that and specifically, the multitude of photographs rather than photography itself.
How did you arrive at the 18 months?
Oh, that was the length of my commission there. So that was kind of the time I had to work with.
And so the people who owned the property up at Austerlitz basically commissioned this work?
They commissioned me to do some artwork for them, and they have this beautiful property, and very generously said, if you want to play around in any way, I approached them eventually with the idea of the cameras and just sort of make sure, hey, is it okay? And they said, hey, whatever you want to do. So, I do.
So that was great. Huh?
I do have to, I won't mention their names because they're very, very private, but I do have to thank them for that because I felt like I had this woodland to myself to just play in. And it was such a great experience.
And these were people who must have known your work from somewhere. Was
yes.
That it?
Yeah. Yeah. They had previously seen some other installation work of mine and were interested in me coming on and, kind of exploring their land. They had recently purchased it, so I think for them, it was a way, kind of vicariously, of experiencing the land. I'm intrepid, Richard. So I went off into all sorts of corners of the forest and would sort of report back periodically what I had seen, and it was great. It was a great relationship for that time, and I really, I greatly appreciated their openness to what I was doing.
Are they themselves weekenders, or they live there all the time?
No, they are. They're weekenders. So this was also part of the deal. They would come up, and I would be there, and I, kind of breaking in the land for them, I guess, in some way, shape, or form. So
informal residency kind of a situation.
It was, yeah, and. Yeah, it's a really, really delightful. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of land. So,
when Edna St. Vincent Millay moved up there, people thought she was out of her mind. They said, "How could you live so far away?"
Oh yeah, like I've yet to get. It's funny. I spent so long in that area, and I've yet to go over and see the Millay colony. So, I'll have to take a visit there.
Oh yeah, well definitely. And Steepletop, the garden. I'll put in a little plug. The garden is being restored to her original design.
Really?
And she set it up as a series of rooms. And, she was quite a pistol.
I know of her life. I read her the biography Savage Beauty years and years ago.
Uh-huh. So they they were notorious for having nude swimming and the outdoor bar where somebody went wild and shot a bullet through it.
The good old days.
But it was far away. I suppose a lot of people came and stayed there.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a great place to see and visit.
Yeah.
And the residencies across the way at the Millay Colony, that Steepletop was the home. Her sister set up Millay Colony, and they have residencies for art, visual artists and writers.
Writers, yeah.
So you showed me a small catalog of paintings. Why don't you talk about that? You were talking about time in those.
Yeah, this is work that I made sort of concurrently with the kind of the time-lapse stuff, as you know, as the cameras were shooting and I was doing some drawing. I also, basically, I've just explained, it's work on canvas. I make it outside primarily, which means that I had these big bolts of canvas actually in the woods, and doing the
so that they will be exposed to the elements, basically.
Yeah, it's a little bit. There's a practical element because I use materials like I'll use a lot of metal filings and things that are reactive. Obviously, you get the reaction from the moisture in the air and a probe.
So, say something rusts if it's iron, and
exactly,
that leave
yeah.
a mark on the canvas.
Exactly. And then there's a kind of, I don't know what to call it, sympathetic magic or a sort of shamanistic element to it where. Because the subjects are, astrological. And so, for instance, an image kind of showing how an equinox works or the position of the planets at equinox and how they move through time. And, you know, the sympathetic magic, I just think, like, the exposure to the starlight and the kind of just being, something about being outside imbues them, not just physically, but kind of metaphysically with a meaning that I can work with.
So. How long would a piece of a particular canvas stay outside?
It depends. You know, the one I did about the equinox, I left it from equinox to equinox. So I, you know, where I can, I try to calibrate the subject of the canvas with the length of time. I have one that sort of explores. Actually, I have quite a few that explore the notion of like what a year is, and so I would leave them out for a year.
And when you say leave them out, you got them strung up on trees or something? Or?
I lay them flat
on the ground.
On the ground, and the other magic part of it and ingredient in my work is gravity. You know, just this idea of them being pressed to the earth and also using gravity to shape some of the images, pouring paint on it or solvent or something and letting gravity kind of do its thing. You know, I'd use the angle of the ground to control things. And it's interesting, Richard, because what ended up happening to me, I actually call it, despite them being in the woods, I call it urban Paleolithic, because I'm kind of trying to create this, I guess, an underpainting, part by chance and then part kind of deliberately and going back in, kind of like the...
Are you performing this or that act upon it all through? Or do you start by putting some paint and some filings and leaving it there and then that's that and nature does the rest? Or do you go back and put more... add more elements.
I try to alternate between those two kind of. It's kind of a two-stroke process where it's control and release. But you know my references are the cave paintings at Lascaux, where you have these beautiful paintings. And what they did is they kind of interpreted the rock. So if they saw a horse's head, they'd kind of complete it. Or if they saw a bison, they would complete it. And similarly, I'll go back and kind of see what the elements have left, and then kind of try to interpret it, that way. If that makes sense, as a kind.
So you mean that they would see veins in the rock, and they would have the outline of something, and work from that.
Yeah, and oftentimes what I find, I'll plan a painting, set it out. And something really unexpected will happen and kind of force me to reconsider the composition. And that's when I'll go back in and I'll try to boost it one way a little bit. And, I've lost them in the sense of, let nature kind of have its way too much with it. I actually have one painting where mice kind of destroyed the central image. I left it for so long. I actually think I'd forgotten about it. I came back and it was just full of holes. And I think they took it for their nests or something. The body work is called Terminal Velocity and Other Stories. And the terminal velocity comes from a particular painting where it's just a huge kind of ball of rust, basically, and the equation for terminal velocity sort of trailing off. And each work, you know, I hope both tells a story about what we know about the world in terms of physics and astronomy, and then also speaks to the experience itself of, you know, it being out in nature and sort of just a more temporal kind of story, I guess. So the two of those, try to fuse those together, because really my, like, two alternating concerns or interests are, you know, how do we know all this stuff in the first place? You know, that the Earth goes around the sun or the moon, you know, all the sort of stuff that we discovered in the Renaissance. And then how do we experience it? You know, a sun sets, but it's actually, you know, just the giant shoulder of the Earth turning. So that kind of, I don't know, that kind of tension in being aware of what something is, but then experiencing physically as such a different thing. That's kind of what propels these paintings for me. You know, I'm trying to find, I don't know, I'm trying to find this sweet spot or this kind of middle ground or some understanding, and also to let, you know, in a way, I call them stories because it's the story of how we know our world as moderns, you know.
Now,
physics
I'm sure this shows that I'm pathetically ignorant, but what does terminal velocity mean?
Oh, it's the point at which something just, it will not fall faster. It's going as fast as it can, and terminal velocity is—it's basically the rate of speed is constant. So as something falls, it every
keeps doubling its
speed.
Yeah,
every second per second, it kind of it's speeding up till it hits terminal velocity, where that's just it.
Is that the same for every object, regardless of weight?
Yes. Yes, it is. As Galileo proved. You know, this was one of his big things, and they actually, interestingly, I when one of the moon landings, they proved this by dropping a hammer and a feather in zero gravity, and they fell at the same speed, which you can see that on YouTube. I've watched it many times. Recommend it.
Well, you can find everything on YouTube.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, everything is on YouTube.
Do you put any of your have you put any of your projects on YouTube?
I have, actually. Yeah, yeah. And what these videos, I kind of upload them semi-regularly up to a YouTube page and then post them, you know, on my Facebook. I'll link them to my Facebook page to let my friends and let my mother know what I'm doing. So.
And your next project, you said, is something in conjunction with the Wendy McDerris Gallery.
Yeah, I'm going to be an artist in residence in there. And so the Kite's Nest program is part of that. As far as my own sort of artistic trajectory, I'm not sure yet. And as we were talking about, I really do hesitate to say because I know it's going to change. But, you know, I really think, you know, in general, for me anyway, I have this territory that that feels very much like mine. I have certain, interests and obsessions. And I just will follow those and see what happens. So.
And you feel at home here.
I do. I love the Hudson Valley. Hudson itself is great. And
did you grow up in the country or in the city?
No, I grew up in Toronto. So I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto. And, we had ravines and these sorts of things. And I would spend summers up in, we call it cottage country. It's the lakes north of the city. And my dad was a big outdoorsman. So I'm kind of well acquainted and equipped to be in the out of doors. What I love, the location of Hudson is amazing because you have the Berkshires, you have the Catskills, you have the river. I mean, there's a geographical diversity here that is that's really astounding.
Actually, you know, there are 27 distinct ecosystems in Columbia County.
I didn't know that, but I'm gonna have to find out more. Really?
Yeah, I learned this from DEC.
Wow. Okay. Well, I know geologically it's also an area of interest because it's been apparently been flipped upside down. So sometimes you get older rocks on top of younger rocks, and I don't know. It's that kind of diversity and that kind of I don't know, the signs of change, the signs of like deep time moving through our world that draw me. And I think that's that's a lot of the reason why I'm here, because there's just a lot of material, like and a past of, you know, and plus the seasonal change, which I grew up with, and I also really love. So, you know, time manifesting itself through the landscape.
What kind of work did you do in Brooklyn?
One of the projects I did was I took canvas. So I live very close to a canal, the Gowanus Canal, which is an interior, you know, an old shipping canal that goes up through one of the neighborhoods. And one day I sort of noticed that has this tidal. It's a tidal canal, so it goes up and down. And my background is printmaking. And I noticed on the walls you get these great marks from the tide going up and down. And in a kind of slow motion, it's a bit like a printing press, the way you kind of swipe a squeegee across the screen or something. So a couple of years, I would hang these canvas along the wall of the canal, imprinted with information about tides, imprinted with information about the particular month I would hang them, and get the water from the canal to basically kind of develop them almost photographically, again, using kind of reactive material.
Notoriously reactive Gowanus Canal.
Well, you know, when I first started, I had no idea, and very soon I discovered how deeply polluted it was. So I would go out in a Tyvek suit and rubber gloves to retrieve them. I would drag them back to my studio, wash them off, kind of seal them, because there's quite a bit of nastiness. They don't glow in the dark, which would have been really cool, but and again, it kind of goes back to my obsession about this tidal, the mechanics of the tide, and just how quietly in the background these rhythms are happening.
How much of a change would there be in high tide and low tide?
8 feet in some places, because it narrows quite a bit toward the end, so and the narrower it is, width-wise. So the narrower it is, I think the height differential was greater. But quite a bit. And I never fell in, thankfully. Just for
do
the
they
record.
Still use it for shipping things through?
Not that I know of. There are a lot of foundries. Part of the reason why it's so polluted is there are a lot of foundries brass and copper and things, and that's what they would be shipping. I think they use a part of it anyway, but kind of higher up on the canal, all I see are, strangely, recreational kayakers and canoers.
Is that right?
Oh. Yeah. No, there's a.
And what neighborhood of Brooklyn does that go through?
Carroll Gardens, Borum Hill, that kind
so
of.
So it's fairly close to Brooklyn Heights and so on, in Manhattan.
Yeah. No, it's right up in there. And I know it's a super fun site, and maybe they'll clean it up, but the good old Gowanus Canal.
Yeah, it's a bit of a legend.
Yeah.
Then you showed me also a project you did with some...
Oh, in Croatia.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit. It's called Here.
Yeah, so I was at a residency in Germany last year, and out of that, I was asked to go to Zagreb to do an installation for a painting show, and it was a German-American and Croatian painters in this terrific gallery. It was a huge round gallery. So the walls were curved and
in Zagreb, in the city.
In the city of Zagreb. So it was a museum there, and the installation was a trail of bread pieces that went and sort of meandered through the gallery space. And because it's circular, if you were to follow it, you could follow it ad infinitum. So part of me was amused just by laying down a trail that went kind of nowhere. The breadcrumbs in the trail obviously refers to the Hansel and Gretel myth. And
right.
As, everyone forgets that didn't work. The birds came and took all the breadcrumbs away. And it was a little bit, I think I called it both like an elegy for the show. It was a guide, something that was constant as people would go around and see.
And people were encouraged to follow the trail.
Oh, yeah. And as you walked around to see the paintings on the wall, this sort of trail accompanied you through your kind of journey. And it would wax and wane in volume, but was sort of present there. And it was, to kind of designed to tie the whole thing together.
How long did the breadcrumbs remain in place?
I think the show was up for a month.
Oh,
Huh? So yeah, I was only there for 10 days, and it was in, you know, I got there and I had a vague idea of what I would do, but once I got in the space, like it would kind of cemented it, and I thought, okay, this is.
And you said this grew out of a residency in Germany, actually.
Yeah, I was in Leipzig and doing a residency, which was a joint North American European residency. So Croatia has just entered the European Union, and it was sponsored by the German government, Croatian government, and I had applied through a friend, been accepted, and. It was meant to sort of facilitate. It was a giant open studio where we all worked together. So Germans, Croatians, Americans, Canadians were meant to, you know, we weren't working on a project together, but just simply by proximity of space, we were kind of, you know, the idea was that we would feed each other and there would be an exchange of ideas.
Is this kind of thing common out in the world where people from various countries come together and share a space or whatever?
I think so. I mean, this was I think for me, this was unique insofar as there were. You didn't have you had a dedicated piece of wall in this giant room, but you didn't have a studio dedicated. So, you know, different residencies were functioned differently. This one just encouraged interaction and the international aspect. I think, well, particularly in Europe, like I think this is really quite common that when they, you know. There's a residency, you're going to get people from 8 different countries. And, right. You know,
they're not that far
They're away. Not that far apart. So I was really excited to participate in it for that reason, just because I knew there would be a lot of different viewpoints in the room. And yeah, it was terrific. It was really terrific.
What sort of got the ball rolling for all these? I mean, it sounds like you've had really very nice luck in getting interesting places to do things.
What got the ball rolling? How did I get into this racket? that's a great question. You know, I for years, I have a degree in literature, and for years wanted to...
In English literature.
In English literature, yeah, and was an aspiring writer for a very long time. Not very successfully, in some ways, thankfully. When I couldn't write, which was often, I would either read, which I for... grateful for. I've read a lot of books and I would make things, and it was sort of noted by actually friends of mine that I seemed to be much happier making things than trying to write things.
Well, that's frustrating somehow.
Yeah, and at a certain point I just thought, well, maybe this is what I should be doing. And I've backfilled some of my education. You know, I spent time at the Art Students League doing figure drawing to kind of get some basic chops down. And and yeah, I feel really fortunate because I both love what I do, and I've gotten some really good feedback. And frankly, I've been really lucky. You know, there's no luck plays no small part in some of this. So, but I think enjoying it's really been the key for me, and that's helped me keep up the enthusiasm. And
you were writing fiction when you were writing?
Oh yeah. You know, the great Canadian novel or something like this. I don't know what I still enjoy writing, but I don't take it seriously. And it's one of those activities that, I think it's best left as a hobby for me.
Now, in Toronto, is there a kind of a contemporary art scene that would be analogous to, say, Brooklyn or New York City?
That's a good question. I mean, there's nothing analogous to New York City.
Yeah, right, in terms of scale.
Yeah, unless it's Berlin or Los Angeles or something like this. It's interesting. The arts in Canada, it's a little bit more structured insofar as there's less of a commercial market. And so there are more government grants, which is terrific. There's a lot of public support. But one of the effects of that is to sort of stratify the art scene. So you have emerging artists, mid-career artists, and I think they call them established artists. And so I may make it sound incredibly deeply communist or socialist or something, but no, it's you know, again, maybe there's nothing analogous to Brooklyn too in Toronto, just simply because it's I mean,
but people. A large number of people might be considered for grants. it sounds the way it sounds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess the short answer is yeah. There is a thriving contemporary art scene in Toronto, but somehow the spirit and structure is just it's very different. I mean, it's very Canadian, and I don't know if that will translate very very well.
There are commercial galleries.
There are of course commercial galleries. Oh yeah, yeah.
And nonprofit spaces.
Yes. Yeah, lots of artist-run centers, that sort of thing. And, you know, and my experience anyway of Brooklyn is that it's commercially driven.
There's less non... I was talking to a friend yesterday, yeah. as a matter of fact, about how there used to be things like Artist Space and White Columns and all these non-commercial spaces, yeah. which yeah. don't seem to have much influence anymore.
No, they don't. They don't. And it's a little... I don't know. It's too bad, but then the upside for me, especially... coming from that different culture, something that's a little bit more structured, is feels a little bit like the Wild West. Like, I'm not sure if there was a canal in Toronto, A, if I would get away with it, you know, just going and hanging some canvas there. I mean, I think people might have something to say about it. And just the spirit of it, I don't know, this is going to sound crazy, but it's America, and if you can do it, you're allowed. And this is really something that I find unique to the culture here, as opposed to Europe or Canada, where people, you know, the first question is, where did you go to school? Or where, you know, where were you trained? Especially in Europe, where were you trained? And, you know, the insinuation is that you can't be an artist without training, which I agree with, you know, fundamentally, but... in Brooklyn, it's like, what are you doing? Like, and where is it? Or what's happening? And you know, like, it's just a little more, you just have that much more freedom.
Now, in Hudson, do you find that there's a exchange between artists?
There is. You know, I because I spent, you know, during the project, I spent a lot of time in the woods and a lot of time sort of isolated. I was, Austerlitz, you know, it's what, about a half an hour away. So... just in my visit here, I'm just sort of slowly getting acquainted with the art scene here. And, yeah, I mean, it seems promising. There's certainly a lot going on, so.
And at night you go and hang out at the, go hang the out pubs at the bars.
The Spotty and Dog and the Half Moon. And, yeah, I mean, it's...
There's lots of music. Do you like music?
I do like music. I'm not very educated. I'm lazy about music. Put it this way, Richard. I have to be told what to, like, sort of, hey, have you heard this? You know, and then I listen to the same album for, you know, 6 months or something. So,
do you listen to the music shows on GXC?
I've started to, yeah. Yeah, so, and I can't, I'm trying to think of some of the names. I liked Daniel Bunny Brains.
Right, he has a very popular show.
Yeah,
he's one of those people who does know everything in terms of music, I think.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah, down at John Doe there. So, yeah. So, yeah, I look forward to kind of in the fall when I come back, just digging in and seeing what's going on. And as I say, getting involved in Kite's Nest and you know, doing the residency with Wendy McDerris there. So, yeah, no, I'm very much looking forward to it. So.
Now, at Kite's Nest, do they have a sort of emphasis? I mean, are they particularly interested in one kind of, say, natural world kind of thing, or gardening, growing things? What is their?
I think it's there's a health like a healthy reflection of the area's interest, which is there's. You know, local agriculture, and but I don't. You know, that's a good question. I think probably I would defer that to them in terms of. But from what I can see, they're pretty open to.
You know, let a teacher come in, or whatever artist teacher come in and offer whatever he wants.
Yeah, yeah. I think that they're you know what they're looking to do is you know engagement, skills, and fun. I think you know they're really. They really want to, you know, they want to engage kids and, yeah, give them a kind of both teach and delight, you know, as the old adage goes. So.
Well, happiness leads to concentration.
Ah, okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say, David?
Richard, this has been fantastic. I thank you for having me on your show. And I look forward to maybe in a year or so when I'm deeply involved in another project, we can chat again and get an update or something.
Update me.
But thank you very much for having me. This has been delightful. So
thank you for coming.
Yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Bab Amal and Taj Mahal with Trouble Sleep Yanga Wake Am.